This work was conducted at Rice University. I myself am now at the National Institute of Standards and Technology, and Stephen Goggin is now at the University of California, Berkeley. But our hearts will always be at Rice. So I'll start by acknowledging the National Science Foundation and the Accurate Center for funding this work, and also local election officials, specifically from Brazoria and Victoria County, Texas. They were really instrumental in helping us procure some of our voting equipment. So sort of the boring usual overview, you know, start with the research aims or goals of this particular work. I'll discuss some prior research that's relevant, and then spend a lot of time on the method, so please stop me if you have any questions. And then obviously conclude with some results and general discussion. So, why electronic voting machines? I kind of don't have to answer this as much as I thought I was going to based on the previous talks that we've heard today. But one thing that comes up is, well, since a lot of counties now are moving away from electronic voting machines and back to optical scan paper ballots, why should we still be studying this? Why should we still be studying these machines and different types of usability features that we might be able to implement? Well, there are several compelling reasons. Some of these that they've been alluded to already today, that the potential for accessibility accommodations with electronic voting machines that simply don't necessarily exist with paper-based systems. And you're always going to need some sort of accessibility accommodation. So that's one reason. That is not what this talk is about, but that is an important reason. And what we're really interested in is the fact that electronic voting machines offer the opportunity to present the ballot in novel ways. Yet we really have not systematically explored this space. So really, again, we're going to need baseline data, not just against older voting methods, but for the current electronic voting machines that we have, we need to know how specific design features impact the usability so that we have some data against which we can compare these future and emerging technologies. So that is one of our main focuses. So we really want to widen the space of DRE design inquiry. Specifically, how does changing the ballot navigation model impact usability? So most of you guys are super familiar with, obviously, the voting world as it currently stands, and most popular commercial DREs are sequential ballot navigation. So you have the race for president, you have the race for, you know, representative, all the way down to county dog catcher, propositions at the end, and you go sequentially in the same order, the fixed order. You're in this fixed order, moving sequentially through the ballot. Hence, sequential navigation. But we don't have to display the ballot that way in an electronic system. You can do whatever you want, essentially, with computers, right? I'll get into, obviously, more detail and show you screenshots and such. But we manipulated ballot navigation model. Our second goal was to explore the relationship between the residual vote and true error rate through experimental work. And again, I'll get into explanations of what the residual vote rate is. Basically, it's an indirect measure of voter error that's commonly used in political science and in the field. So because we're doing a laboratory study, we can control for things and measure things that you can't necessarily get at explicitly in the real world. So we have some prior work out of the same lab at Rice that found while the overall average residual vote and the true error rates may be similar, the variability in one is not necessarily mirrored by the variability in the other. There's a ton of prior work that is obviously relevant. I'm not going to get into all of it here. We're focusing primarily on our previous experimental work, in part because we've used the same basic methodology across studies, which means we can really more directly compare effects of voting technology and implementation independently of, say, the ballot, the candidates, and such as that. So we've really tried to keep our methodology and our materials as consistent as possible across studies, with some important modifications, which we're talking about. So we directly assess usability of older voting machines. And when I say usability, I mean not just error rates, but the three metrics that are recommended by NIST and ISO. So efficiency, ballot completion time, effectiveness, error rates, and satisfaction, so subjective usability. So some key results from prior research. We found that the methods were pretty comparable in terms of efficiency. So there weren't any drastic differences in terms of timing or ballot completion times across voting methods. the bubble-style paper ballot, so you know the Scantron fill-in-the-bubble, like the SATs that you've all taken, they had superior subjective usability. But they weren't really, again, didn't have these objective benefits. But they were definitely preferred by voters over, say, the mechanical lever machines and punch cards. Disturbingly, we found error rates ranging from 1.5 to 5% per race. And I didn't put the numbers on here for the ballot level, but they were from 11% to 26% of ballots contained at least one error. So that's not so hot. Marking errors. And I will have a very detailed description and explanation of how we actually classified error rates, because we broke them down into the various the constituent components. So we would like some research that directly compares, say, these typical DREs and older voting method, but more importantly, how does novel or how do novel design features like navigation of DREs affect performance, or do they? I mean, we think they should, but you know, that's an empirical question and what we're here to talk about. So the current work, and this is just an overview, I'm gonna get into detailed methods later on, but we compared four voting systems. The DRE, we had sequential versus direct access navigation. And I will explain that and show screenshots in a moment. But that's a really, if you don't pay attention to much else, the fact that we manipulated ballot navigation is really important. So make sure you catch that part. So we had DREs. We also had more traditional methods, so paper ballots, you know, the fill in the bubble, punch cards, and mechanical lever machines. And we used the metrics from the International Organization for Standardization, or ISO, which I'd already mentioned, efficiency, effectiveness, and satisfaction. So, method. We had 64 paid volunteers, pretty even gender split, 30 male, 34 female. And they were recruited from the larger Houston area. This is really important. They are not Rice University undergrads. Okay, these are people from the larger community, as you can tell by the age range. Right, 18 to 77 years, with a mean age of about 50, so definitely not Rice undergrads, but I want to point that out explicitly. Standard deviation of age, about 15 years. And they were diverse in terms of education, ethnicity, and income, so that's good. We want them to be representative of the larger voting public. Again, really important here, primary independent variables, DRE navigation style. This was manipulated between subjects with random assignment to conditions. So half of all participants voted with the direct access DRE. Show you a screenshot in a second. And half of participants voted with a more traditional sequential DRE. Each participant voted two times with their respective DRE. Okay, so you only got the direct access or the sequential, but you voted twice with that system. Make sense so far? Cool. So, this is, don't worry about reading the actual text, that is not important, just to give you an idea of the navigation style. So this is the direct access DRE. So you start with the main page here, and you can see that listed here are all of the races. So this is sort of a pick and choose model, kind of like the hub and spoke model of a web page. So people can actually pick and choose in any order what races they would like to go to. So if I wanted to, I could start with the final proposition. I don't have to even start at president. But say I did want to actually start at president, then I would be taken to that race and then back to the main page. But before I show you an actual race page, I want to point out that here, click to go to step three, record your vote. I'll show you a screenshot of the record vote screen, but it's really important to note that simply clicking on this button does not record your vote. You go to the record vote screen and you still have another action to take. Okay, so that's pretty important. So say you actually, you know, you clicked on president, you go to the presidential race page. So even though the main page, you can see all of the races at once and you can click on any one and go to them in any order, once you get to an actual race page, there's only a single race on it, and it looks nearly identical between the direct access and the sequential. So here you would click to go back to the main page. And this was the record vote screen that I mentioned a minute ago. So you can see here that you still have to take another action before you can record your vote. So simply navigating to the record vote screen does not cast your ballot, okay? And of course, you could go back to the main page from there if you wanted to. Oh, sorry, yeah, go ahead.
So after some selection,
Yes, that is absolutely correct.
And the sequential, did you have to go back to the main menu page, or did it automatically move you through the ballot?
Well, it didn't automatically move you through the ballot, but this is a screenshot of the sequential. There's no equivalent of main page. You start at the presidential race after the instruction screen, and here you click to go forward to the next race. So there's no page. You have to, or you are forced to page sequentially through every race on the ballot until you get to the review screen, which looks just like the main page of the direct access, and then again, finally, to the record vote screen. So whereas with the direct access, you're absolutely right. You have to go to the individual race page, go back to the main screen, race page, main screen, race page, main screen, and then record vote. Whereas sequential, you are forced sequentially through every single race on the ballot before you can get to the review and record vote. Really good point. So, any other questions while we're at this stage? No? Okay. So, method continuing. In addition to voting two times with the DRE, so again, either sequential or direct access navigation, so in addition to those two votes, everybody also voted on one non-DRE voting method. And this was manipulated between subjects, random assignment. So the three non-DRE voting methods were paper ballots, punch cards, and lever machines. You beat me to it, yes. Well, it depends. We have another condition that I'm about to explain that I will tell you a bit about the instructions, but if I haven't answered that question by the end of this slide, let me know. So information condition. We manipulated between subjects with random assignment. So in the undirected information condition, by undirected, I mean they received a voter guide modeled after those by the League of Women Voters. They were allowed to make their own selections, but they were told to vote consistently across ballots. So I hope that answers your question for that information condition. So we either gave them a voter guide, they could read it, it had information about the candidates, the typical voter guide, they could mark on it, keep it with them, whatever they wanted to do with it. But they were instructed to vote consistently across their three ballots. Now, in contrast with the undirected information condition, we had a directed information condition. So users were actually given a piece of paper that said, here is who you must vote for. I think it used nicer language than that. They were given a sheet of paper that listed all the candidates they were supposed to vote for. They kept that with them while voting, and it did list, you know, they're voting for the same people across across methods, but they weren't given any choice in the matter. It is in the same order as presentation, yes. And all of these materials, I'll show a link later, but are available online as well. So within the directed condition, this gets even a little more complicated. We had directed with no roll-off. So roll-off is the tendency for people, you know, it's more common for people to skip, say, the dog catcher race than it is for president. So roll-off rates increase the further down the ballot you go. So with no roll-off, the sheet that they were given that had all the list of candidates they were supposed to vote for, they were told to vote, make a selection in every race. Now, in the directed with moderate roll-off condition, they were instructed to intentionally omit certain races. And the way we picked which races are they going to omit is we based it off a paper, 1995 paper by Nichols and Stryzek, where they broke down the different roll-off rates for electronic machines by, you know, federal office, state offices, county offices. So that's how we determined what races are we going to tell them to skip. Then we had a third directed information condition, which was directed with additional roll-off. So on this, they had an even higher likelihood of being told to omit a race. And I think it was 52% likelihood that for any given race, they would be instructed to omit it. So trying to mimic those voters who really don't go in there to vote for very many races at all. Is this making sense so far? Awesome. One thing I forgot to mention is that the non-DRE voting method was in between the two DREs. So you come in, you vote on your DRE, your non-DRE, and then again on your DRE. And here's just pictures of the non-DRE voting methods. I'm sure you guys have all seen these before. It's important to note that the same exact ballot, which makes sense since we're asking people to vote for the same candidates, and it was in the same order. So same ballot on all voting methods. We used fictional candidates. We had, I think back in like 2006, had done an initial study that looked at actually comparing the use of fictional candidates and fictional materials with realistic or real world candidates. And we found that it didn't make any difference. So we thought, hey, why don't we stick with fictional? Then we're not going to have to keep redoing our materials every year. So we used entirely fictional candidates. 21 offices to choose one candidate per office, 6 propositions. And all of these materials are up on the CHIL website, and this is the link that's referenced in the paper. So if you have any, would like to use them or have any more questions, check it out. So error measures. In addition to just looking at whether or not a ballot contained an error, we want to know what kind of error was it exactly. And this is really important once we start talking about comparing error rates with the residual vote. So an extra vote error is a voter makes a selection for a race that they originally intended to skip. An omission or an undervote error, a voter fails to choose a candidate for a race in which they had initially intended to vote. Wrong choice error, that's a little more straightforward. They make a selection other than the one intended. So I vote for Alice when I really meant Bob. And an overvote error is when a voter makes more than the allowed number of choices. Now I should note that is actually only possible with the paper and the punch card methods in the current study, because lever machines prevent that type of error mechanically, and the DRE software that we use prevented it via software. But we didn't actually observe any overvotes here. So is everybody clear thus far on the experimental design, the method, exactly what's happening, and measures of error?
Where did you get the lever machines?
Oh, this is a great story. We got them at an auction in Victoria County, Texas. I had to drive a truck with a hydraulic Tommy lift. I can barely park a 2-door Honda Civic, so this was interesting. So we had to drive the truck all the way out into the middle of nowhere and actually bid on them at auction. And it was just like something out of the movies, you know, somebody with a bolo tie and the big belt buckle in the middle of nowhere, and you couldn't understand a word he's saying, and I just kept raising my thing because I didn't want to miss our chance. But yeah, it was a good story. But absolutely, the election officials were super helpful in helping us procure those, letting us know about the auction. We had to get somebody from Victoria County up to help us program the lever machines. Yeah, they are really, really complicated. I don't know if you've ever looked in the back of them. Quite complex. Okay. So you know what I'm talking about. Yeah, I keep thinking we should actually try to see if we can get it on that show, American Restoration, right? And we can maybe be famous. Might. Yeah. Scrap metal, yeah. We bought, I think, just 2 out of a lot of, 100 something, and the gentleman after just bought the rest for scrap metal. So, yeah, I know. It's kind of sad. But at least we have a little piece of history. Yeah?
Did you say how many races or candidates there were?
Yes, 27 total races, 21 for candidates, and 6 propositions. And they're all choose one. Sure. Do you want me to go back to that slide? No, let's not do that. So the roll-off conditions, so we had 3 different roll-off conditions. We had 3 undirected information conditions where we told people who to vote for. Of those, one of them had absolutely no roll-off, so they were instructed to make a selection on every race on the ballot. And then the other 2 had roll-off. One had moderate roll-off, so that was what we had, where we were basing our roll-off rates on the Nichols and Strizek 1995 paper. And then the other one had additional roll-off, where every race had a 52% probability of being omitted, right? So that was to try to get mimic even higher roll-off rates. It was always DRE, non-DRE, and then DRE. So there wasn't actually. One of the things I didn't get into in the current paper due to space constraints Is that one of my first master's studies was actually looking at implementing state information. So you're on race 1 of 27, 2 of 27. And that was why I'd initially had the two DREs, because one had state information, one did not, and I counterbalanced the order of those. There are absolutely no significant differences across anything, depending on whether it had state information or not, or whether it was first or third. So I expect if we had a longer ballot, that absolutely there would be something like that. But you know, ours was not anything like the 100 ballot, you know, 100 candidate things that we've been hearing horror stories of. I will get into the efficiency results. Yeah, great question. I should let you give the presentation. You've read it or something. But yeah, so any other questions at this point? Okay. So what did we find? I know in the beginning I mentioned efficiency, effectiveness, satisfaction, but because effectiveness or error rates are really the most interesting and critical thing here, I'm going to be talking about those first and then save timing and satisfaction results for the very end. So if you guys are scanning the total error column, you will notice immediately that this 14.5 compared to, I don't know, 1, not quite 2%, less than 1, should really jump out at you. Okay, go over here. That's our direct access nav DRE. So what's really driving that is you can definitely see that it is this 13.1% omission rate. And that's omitted errors. So that's those are undervote errors. Not on purpose. They're not abstaining. These are errors. That's a big number. I mean, think about some of the margins of victory that we've had in big, important elections. That's big. How many times can I say big?
Yep.
And so it's where essentially you have this, you can see all of the races at the same time and pick and choose exactly which ones you want to go to. Yeah. This is a really good question, and I realized after you just asked it that I forgot to mention one thing when I was doing those error definitions of the extra vote, undervote, and such, is that you notice all of them had to do with voter intent. They intended to leave it blank. They intended to make a vote. They intended Bob, not Alice. So how do you measure voter intent? Well, in the directed condition where we gave them a sheet to vote for, they intend to vote for the people listed on that sheet. Now, in the undirected information condition where they could vote whoever they want to, since we instructed them to vote consistently across methods, we did a simple majority rule. So, the discrepant ballot or voting method was where the error was attributed to. Thanks for catching that. So, but to answer your question, it is the number of errors at that individual race level. So we'll break it down further when we start talking about residual vote to top ballot and down ballot. But yeah. Okay. So those omission errors, that 13 point something a rate that I showed on the previous slide, obviously significantly greater for direct access DRE than sequential. But this is really being driven by a particular type of error that has sort of bigger consequences than just making a mistake on a single single race. So 8 out of 32 people, or 25%, actually cast their ballot prematurely with direct access DRE. This is an error that we hadn't seen before in our work. So that means that in some cases they hadn't made a single selection and they went ahead and cast their vote. And the number of selections and choices that they'd made varied, but the fact that you are casting your vote before you are done making your selections is not so hot, right? I mean, you have disenfranchised yourself, you're done. At least in this type of scheme where you can't submit multiple ballots. Well, is it Estonia where it's like you can keep casting and casting and casting and only the final one counts? I'm trying to remember. Norway, thank you. We did both in the same trip. So 8 out of 32 people, 25%, cast the vote prematurely with the direct DRE. 0 people with the sequential. We also saw something that has been reported, you know, in the literature, the fleeing voter problem, where people actually fail to cast their ballot entirely. So they make all their selections, they get to the review screen. Sometimes they leave it on the review screen. Sometimes they leave it on the record vote screen. but they don't actually press the cast ballot button or record vote. And it kind of depends on if you have a nice person that comes up after you and they see that it's, you know, not been cast, they might go call the poll worker, and depending on the laws of that state and the poll worker may cast it for you, they may not. A malicious voter could come up and see that, you know, someone hasn't cast it and change all your votes. But either way, you have some chance of it still being cast for you and counted. Whereas with that first type of error, if you cast it before you're ready and you don't have your selections made, there's no coming back from that. At least not in this scheme. So for this post-completion error, 4 out of 32 people, or about 12.5%, failed to cast the vote with the direct access DRE, and only 2 of 32 people did so with the sequential. So before now, we've been talking about errors, and undervote errors, omission errors, omissions, undervote, same thing. But there's a type of omission, an undervote, that is not actually an error. People can rationally abstain. They don't care about County Dog Catcher. They're trying to make a political statement that they don't find any of the presidential candidates fit for office. But people choose to abstain all the time. And it's not an error, right? Although in the residual vote, it is captured as such. So here, when I'm talking about intentional abstentions, I will only be referring to the undirected information condition, right? Because it doesn't make any sense for us to examine intentional abstentions for the directed conditions because we told them who to abstain for. So this is really when people are left up to their own devices, they're given the freedom to choose, so the undirected information condition. We found that people using the direct access DRE voted in far fewer races. When I say far fewer, I mean they abstained from nearly half of all races. That's a lot. So there's an intentional abstention rate of about 45%. That's a lot, especially when you compare it to the sequential DRE, where they almost never abstained from a race. There, the intentional abstention rate was not even 1%, 0.7%. So that's a huge difference. Like, we were not expecting to have such a big result just from changing that one ballot design feature of navigation. I think I need to speed it up a little bit. So those using the direct access DRE were therefore significantly faster. It makes sense, they're only voting in like half the races. But this difference in timing was only at the overall ballot completion time. If you look at per race voting times, they're similar between navigation types, which makes sense because, you know, it's the same at the individual race level. You only have one race on a page and it's identical. You look confused. Sure. Because intentional abstentions, are you talking about the undirected or the directed information condition? If it's an intentional abstention, they should have skipped it across all three voting methods. And so that case, it wouldn't be counted as an error, it'd be an intentional abstention on all. If it was an undervote error, an omission error, they would have voted in that race on, you know, 1, 2 out of the three and then left it blank on the third. Surely it's not perfect, but it is way better than we can get in the field, where you can't distinguish intentional from omission errors at all. Yeah? You're still one step ahead of me. Overall, ballot completion times, I've got a graph later, but the direct access DRE was much faster than the sequential, and the sequential and the older methods didn't really have that much of a difference between them, but the mean times are later. So moving on to our second research aim was, again, examining the relationship between the residual vote and what would be reported as the residual vote versus the true error rate as we captured in our study. So as I mentioned, the residual vote's an indirect measure of voter error that is commonly used in political science, and it reflects the total number of votes for any given race that can't be counted. So it's an indirect measure of accuracy. So it's comprised of overvote errors, omission errors, and intentional abstentions, because you can't tell the difference between an intentional abstention and an omission error in the field, because you have to know voter intent. It doesn't have any information on wrong choice errors, right? Because you know, choosing A when you meant candidate B is not going to spoil your ballot. And there's, again, as I mentioned several times, no differentiation between the different types of omission. And furthermore, it's complicated by the fact that requirements to report the unrecorded votes vary by state. And I'm sure some of the election officials in the room can speak to that more than I ever could, but it definitely does vary. So we want to know how accurate is the residual vote as a measure of voter error. So again, you must know voter intent to answer this question. So we explicitly track this, right? And so we actually have a more direct measure of accuracy because we can break up our error rates and determine what was intentional versus not. So again, how well does the true error rate correlate with what you would have been, what would have been reported in the real world? So these are only for the top ballot presidential, so just the presidential race. You have the residual vote versus the true error rate. And the reason I've done only the top ballot or presidential race here is that that's very common to do. So a lot of times people say presidential and then all of the rest of the down ballot races. So you can see here that navigation type, so we have sequential GRE on the left, direct access GRE on the right. So there's not too much difference between the true error rate and residual vote rate. But when you get to the direct access GRE, there is. And I'll show you the inferentials for this in one more slide. But first, I would like to show you the down ballot residual vote. So this is every race other than the presidential one. And again, you can see this difference between sequential GRE error rate versus residual vote rates, not too big. The difference between the direct access GRE and then the for the residual vote and the true error rate is a bit bigger. So here are the inferential statistics that accompanied that first graph, so just the presidential top ballot race. There was the correlation between the residual vote and the true error rate was not significant. In fact, it was oddly slightly negative. And the difference in means was not reliable either. And the similar pattern of results for the direct access navigation where the correlation between the residual vote and true error rate was not significant, nor was the difference in means reliable. I don't want to take up too much time on boring inferential statistics, but these are the numbers for down ballot races, so everything other than president. We have a similar pattern of results where the correlation is not necessarily significant, the difference in means is not significant, but I did forget to mention one important point. All of this to say that the fact that we're finding these non-significant correlations doesn't mean that the residual vote is not useful and informative. I'm not saying that whatsoever. It just means that we may need some more information. We may need some more research because the non-significant correlations suggest that that residual vote rate that we've been, you know, traditionally assuming to be the best measure that we have suggests that it may not be actually as tightly coupled to the true error rate as we've, you know, typically assumed. So, moving on. Here you are, ballot completion times. Thank you for being patient. So you can see right away that the information condition, undirected condition, definitely is taking the longest, but that's really driven by the length of time it takes in the sequential GRE condition. So the sequential GRE undirected, where they get to pick whoever they want, those times were nearly twice that of the direct GRE, which makes sense, right? If they're voting in half the races, they're obviously not reading the voter guide once they've decided not to vote in that race. And so that's not really surprising, but you know, may affect significant interaction, I should say, between navigation style and information condition significant. And then so it you know, just kind of follows the same pattern there. Sure. 27. 21 offices and then 6 propositions. And satisfaction. So sequential GRE, not surprisingly, given our previous work, was very, very rated as high in subjective usability. So the SUS stands for System Usability Scale. It's a 10-item Likert-style questionnaire that asks people to say, hey, I thought this system was easy to use, you know, 1 to 5. I thought I needed help to use the system, questions like that. And it's something that's been used and, you know, verified and validated and across a lot of domains. And so scores of 100 are better, scores of 0, not so hot. And so the difference between navigation types was significant, and people overall preferred the sequential GRE to any of the other voting methods. And direct GRE was like, no. That's the technical term for it, no. So just to wrap up, I think I'm right on time. DREs were no better than traditional methods in terms of efficiency and effectiveness. That's not surprising given what we've seen in previous work, but it's nice to continue to have more data points. The main point of the whole talk, I would say, main point number one, is that manipulation of just a single design feature, just navigation style, significantly impacted both subjective and objective usability. Whereas before, we haven't seen many objective differences between voting methods. I should say, you know, for some populations, such as older voters, we've seen differences in like lever machine versus punch card. But overall, we really haven't seen many differences in objective usability, meaning ballot completion times and error rates. Here, we are getting this drastic, drastic impact, not just on the objective, but also the subjective. So we have to be careful, right? It's great to try new things and to evaluate new technologies, but you better test it before you deploy it. Please. So again, as I mentioned, best subjective usability ratings with the sequential DRE. The direct access DRE was significantly faster, if you don't care about the fact that it was also way more error prone. And it had these new type of error with the premature ballot casting that we hadn't seen before. And the rate of intentional abstention was much higher for the direct access DRE. So remember, they were voting in like not even half of all races. And as I just mentioned, you know, that new type of specific error where they would cast the ballot prematurely, in addition to seeing the one we had seen before, which is the fleeing voter where they fail to cast their ballot. So consistent with some previous work, our data are indicating that the residual vote rate may not be as tightly coupled to the true error rate has been traditionally assumed. So the mean error rate generated by both measures is approximately the same. So, you know, as a tool to detect these large-scale usability problems across many voters, it's still probably a really good tool. I definitely don't want to give the impression that we're saying no to residual vote. It is so, so, so important, and it's something, a measure that we have across a ton of field studies and across years of political science work, and that is really, really important. Simply saying that we may want some more research in the laboratory setting where we can control and piece out, you know, parse out these differences between the omission types. So again, we need voter intent for that, which privacy makes it difficult to do in the real world. I sort of already alluded to that it's kind of impossible to address some of these issues in real elections. We can't and shouldn't go manipulating design features, even if it's just one feature, for a real-world election without having done some type of usability testing, like a heuristic view, N of 5, something. But we've seen that manipulating a single design feature can really have significant impacts on the overall system usability. So, test it before you deploy it. And finally, we think, you know, that doing these type of laboratory studies can really act as a complement to field research. So I'm going to copy from our lovely keynote speaker and do this to do my final movements. Am I saying that sequential navigation is the best and the only method of navigating a ballot? No! I am saying it is better than the direct access navigation model that we implemented. Am I saying that no model of direct access could ever work? No. It's unlikely that we could mitigate some of these errors just by, say, you know, highlighting the undervotes or adding like a warning that says, are you sure you want to cast your ballot? There's blank races. But we need more work in that area. Finally, again, am I saying that the residual vote rate is not useful and informative? No! I am just saying that we need more work. Imitation is the highest form of flattery, right? That's that. Questions? Or maybe we misspelled it in the paper.
Did they do any usability testing? Was their model of what a direct DRE is sufficient
I'll be honest. Go ahead. Oh, that's right. We're being recorded. Oh, well, in that case. Okay. Well, in that case. Just kidding. I would like for you to restate it, pretty please. Thank you.
Sorry.
So all of this massive hand gesturing is lost.
So the question.
Oh dear.
The question which I so rudely asked without the microphone was that in about 2007, Paul Hornsen and his crew published a book that was published by the Brookings Institution, and I had the exact title, but I won't repeat it since I don't remember it, but it had a direct-to-DRE model, and my question was basically, did they do any usability tests? If so, was it a different design? Same design? How does it compare? Are there other directed DRE architectures that might give different results than what you had?
Good question. Is Mike getting up to answer it for me? That would be awesome. It has been quite a while since I have read some of this stuff. I know we definitely, I thought we referenced Hornsen in the paper, but I'm not sure if it's that specific book.
So, yes, we've read that book. What they did was Ben Peterson, who's at the HDI lab at UMaryland, designed a sort of hybrid sequential direct navigation model called the zoomable interface. And you could sort of see this overview and you could kind of zoom in on pieces of it, but it did maintain a linear layout of the ballot so that you did always see sort of the sequence of all the races. Now, I don't think it forced you to go through them in a sequential order, but you always saw them in a sequential order. And they did some usability studies with it, but not the thorough ones they did on the commercial DREs.
Thank you, Mike.
I was just going to mention one thing I noticed in the, in Maryland we had, or in Baltimore City, in the last election we had something like 27 races. And I can't remember exactly how many propositions there were half of them. But people, I watched carefully in early voting. People were voting in 4 minutes, and I think they were getting fed up, actually. So this is a little factor that wasn't, you know, in your thing you were saying, hey, this is a serious test, whereas in the other thing they probably got down to these, you know, vote for all of these judges and things like that, and people just didn't care. So anyway, it was interesting that they voted faster than they did on your test.
Which may also be in part because it's maybe less common for people to go in with a big fat voter guide and actually read through the information and such while they're in the voting place. Not that that is not doesn't happen, but I think aren't there laws that are differ based on whether you can take in the pre-marked?
You're allowed to do that. Yeah. And I looked at it, and you know, a lot of I didn't care either.
Voter apathy.
I think in our experiments at Iowa, we also measured some cases of fed up and wanting to get done. But the question is, each voter was presented with the DRE twice, right? Mm-hmm. And did you measure, did you look at the correlations, error rates of first versus second use for each voter?
So initially, as I think I was explaining to answer one of Josh's questions earlier, was that we had actually, before trying to do 1, 2, 3 ballots or whatever, compared the first versus the second DRE instance across all the different dependent variables and didn't find any significant difference.
So the reason I was wondering is it struck me that voters who were snookered into leaving their voting session early on the first run might have avoided that error on the second run.
Oh, interesting, because I had thought you were going to say the opposite, where the last run, if they're getting kind of tired up and, you know, fed up, that they would be more likely to leave it the second time. Off the top of my head, I don't know that there is any difference depending on whether they had the DRE, it was their first or their second time on the DRE that predicted that, but I certainly, we could go back and
look
at it.
So the second question is related, and that has to do with satisfaction score versus whether they were snookered into leaving early. Because you would think they might have noticed that this had happened and it might lead them to be dissatisfied.
It could, but we've also, we've seen a disassociation between, you know, objective and subjective usability. And so it's quite possible, though, that they were sensitive to the effects of, you know, that this design is making me more error prone. I'm having all these problems, so I don't like it either. So it's quite possible, yeah.
So the third question is the extent to which your menu acted as a summary screen. In a lot of the DRE summary screens, at least in the more mature versions of them, the later Ivotronic, for example, makes a point of highlighting in color the ones that have not yet been voted.
Yep.
So that you can really, so that your undervotes stand out at you, and you're much more likely to make a deliberate decision with regard to them. Yours showed the selections, but did it do any highlighting?
It did not do any highlighting. So I think Campbell and Byrne had done some work in 09 looking at highlighting those review screen undervotes or omissions. Now, the interesting thing that would arise if you tried to do that with the direct access navigation model is that because the main page is like your review screen, when you'd first come in, every single thing would be highlighted.
Yeah.
And so, and because there, again, there's this, you know, rational abstention that is going on, how do you sort of alert people to the fact that they're undervoting and right. when they're doing it in a lot of races, right? Because the signal gets lost in the noise. So yeah, but that's absolutely a really good
but
point.
I guess the takeaway still remains, little tiny changes have huge impacts, and this is dangerous to do without experiments.
And that we need more of these type of experiments. I mean, just because the sequential navigation model is what's really common and it seems to be working pretty well doesn't mean that we shouldn't try new things, right? I mean, technology is there to make us better, and why not try it? But don't do it in a real election. So I think I'm about at time. Yeah, okay. Thank you.